Coming up in Haiti, Fred DeSam Lazaro reports on one priest's successful ministry of healing and shelter, despite natural disasters and failed bureaucracies.
The surprise to everybody, including to us, is that we could do it all pretty much without batting an eyelash.
And a prominent evangelical leader reflects on 25 years in the culture wars. Plus, menorahs and lighting the Hanukkah lamps.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Members of Congress came together this week for the annual lighting of the Capitol Christmas tree, although they were deadlocked on several divisive matters. Religious groups continued advocating for action on the fiscal cliff and other issues. A coalition of religious leaders, law enforcement, and business people urged lawmakers to prioritize immigration reform. The group included both liberal and conservative clergy, who called for legislation that respects the dignity of immigrants, creates a pathway to citizenship, and secures the borders.
It's time to reconcile border security with the security of our values, values that include faith, hope, and charity.
In other news, Jewish groups are divided over Israel's plans to construct new settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The controversial announcement came a day after the United Nations voted last week to recognize Palestine as a non-member state. The Union for Reform Judaism called the proposed settlements a challenge to a future two-state solution, but it also denounced the UN vote as counterproductive to peace. A prominent group of Orthodox rabbis, meanwhile, voiced its support for Israel's decision. In a letter released by the Vatican this week, Pope Benedict XVI issued new rules for charities that identify themselves as Catholic. Benedict instructed such groups to follow Catholic principles in their activity. They're also barred from accepting money from organizations whose work runs counter to church teachings. Although the Pope did not specify, that could apply to funders who promote birth control. Those charities found to violate the new rules can be stripped of their Catholic designation by the local bishop. We have a special report today from Fred DeSam Lazaro in Haiti, where he found an American priest and doctor who's helping thousands of victims of earthquakes, hurricanes, HIV, cholera, and not least, government bureaucracies. Father Richard Frechette and his staff are succeeding not with a big top-down plan, but by listening to what Haitians want.
Early each morning in the chapel of St. Damien's Children's Hospital, the shrouded bodies of infants and one adult on this day are counted, the names written down for prayers that follow at daily Mass.
Anybody that dies in our arms, as they say in Creole, in our place, then their body is first brought to the chapel so that the very next Mass we have the prayers for the dead and for their peace and for the transformation of their life to eternity and for the strength and courage of their family.
Father Rick Frechette spends much of his day attacking the infant mortality he sees so literally each morning. He's the founder of one of the largest medical care facilities for children and many adults in Haiti. It's grown by necessity, often out of tragedy. Frechette is a member of the Community of Passionists, a global Catholic order, and he began 25 years ago with what seemed a more straightforward mission, a shelter and school for orphans. Today, 800 children are housed at several centers. This one, taking in the overflow, functions out of converted shipping containers. The shelter's young managers themselves grew up here. Billy Jean is one. He was brought at age 3 to NPH, the orphanage's local acronym. Today, he works to master English and is in law school.
My mother was pregnant very early, about 16 years old. And then and my father took off. And then my mother couldn't take care of me. And she decided to, she heard about NPH, and she decided to put me there.
His mother visits occasionally, he says, but the orphanage is very much his family.
That's our goal, to restore the family over one generation, to raise the children together so they have memories of their own childhood, restored childhood, and that later in life they become aunts and uncles to each other's children, and their family regenerates after a generation. That's our goal. So we have community of families that have been broken by tragedy.
The tragedy of Haiti's AIDS epidemic beginning in the 90s brought big change for the organization and Frechette himself. HIV was bringing in very ill children that the orphanages were ill-equipped to care for.
That really engraved itself hard on my memory, seeing such terrible things and honestly not having a clue as to what to do.
Frechette received permission from his order to go to medical school, a multi-year commitment which he completed in his mid-40s. Back in Haiti, his newly acquired expertise, combined with astute fundraising, resulted in a modern pediatric hospital. It expanded with a new building in 2006, the largest of its kind in the country, with a 22-bed center for neonatology.
Neonatology is a luxury for Haiti.
Dr. Jacqueline Gauthier is the medical director.
We have central oxygen. We can offer CPAP, which is external ventilation.
So on any given day, you have 22 kids in here who would not have lived.
Correct.
Were it not for correct. This facility.
All the 22s are not very intensive. Half of them.
Many of these premature births result from conditions like hypertension or diabetes in the mothers. For them, a maternity unit was added in 2010 after the capital's major hospital for high-risk pregnancies was destroyed.
Fortunately, 2010, we were not really damaged by the earthquake. So
it
was a few cracks.
That's it.
A few cracks only.
The quake did not damage this hospital, but it quickly overwhelmed it.
The yard was transformed into a trauma center. We had patients everywhere.
In a few weeks, Frechette says the decision was made to use donations that were pouring in to start a new adult hospital. 10 months later, a cholera ward had to be added after the deadly outbreak that killed nearly 5,000 people in its first year.
So we kind of mushroomed out in response to all of these problems. I think the surprise to everybody, including to us, is that we could do it all pretty much without batting an eyelash. And the real wonder of it, to tell you the truth, this is a country of no infrastructures, practically, and it's a country of failed NGOs.
He says 3 years after the quake, despite billions of dollars given to thousands of NGOs, non-government organizations, the rebuilding has been painfully slow.
There's too much disjointedness. It's goodwill, and it should be recognized fully as that and appreciated. But it doesn't get channeled in a way that makes sense, and in fact, it's a way that is disruptive.
Many smaller NGOs, often church-based, have come and gone as their funding allowed. Bureaucracy has slowed larger agencies as they've planned major projects in housing, clean water, and sanitation. Some 360,000 earthquake victims remain displaced in tent camps. For its part, Frechette's organization took in $9 million in earthquake-related donations. Its approach now is focused on community.
Organizations come in with their own ideas and do things their own way. The way that Father Rick works is we don't come into a community and give our idea of what to do and how to do it. We listen to the community, listen to their needs because they know them the best, and then we work together to accomplish it.
In the sprawling Port-au-Prince slum called Cité Soleil, the group is partnering with the community to build homes to replace the sea of shacks and squalor. They're simple two-room structures built on the principle that if you wait to do things right, nothing will get done for years, prolonging the suffering.
The way that we look at it and explain it to our donors, we're investing in the purchase of time. You know, they're simple block structures. We make most of the blocks ourselves. They're simple aluminum roofs. It's more towards normal than anything that they have known, but we're just buying time while the people with big money and big plans and interwoven network of organizations can do a proper urban development. That's what we're doing.
They're also doing healthcare here. A new facility is being built in Cité Soleil. All told, about 1,800 Haitians work for the mission begun by Frechette. Hundreds of thousands have been served in orphanages, schools, and hospitals. Funding comes from private individuals, foundations, and government grants. This year, Frechette was awarded the $1 million Opus Prize, given to a faith-based social entrepreneur by the Minnesota-based Opus Foundation. Frechette himself does not see his work in charitable or heroic terms.
Rather than saying, I gave you this chance, I say, I was fortunate I had that chance. It came to me. I didn't make it. And we want that same chance to come to you so that we have the same chance. We're people who care by being the bridge between resources that have benefited us in our life for our education and well-being, and we just want to be the bridge for letting that happen by people who have their own capacity and dreams.
A long road, he admits, where success is built one small stretch at a time. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazaro in Cité Soleil, Haiti.
We talked this week to one of the most prominent leaders of the evangelical Christian right. He's Richard Land, president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Land plans to retire from the commission next October after 25 years as an outspoken leader in the culture wars. Many observers have seen in recent polls and in last month's election returns evidence of a decline in the influence of evangelical conservatives, a setback for the causes Land has led. But he concedes no such thing.
I think it's not a fair reading. For instance, on the pro-life issue, a majority of Americans now say that they are pro-life.
I thought that legal abortion in almost all cases is favored.
The question about whether it should be legal in most cases is a different question. And the percentage who would make it illegal in most cases is actually going up. And when you begin to peel the onion, you discover that the reason that a majority now say that it's pro-life is that for the last 39 years, pro-life people have been having their babies and pro-choice people have not been having their babies with near as much frequency. And so there's a huge shift. The younger you are, the more likely you are to be pro-life.
But what about the votes in support of gay marriage, which Land opposes vigorously? Was that a setback for him?
These four state elections where the same-sex marriage folks won are four of the most liberal states in the country. They won with a high of 52% of the vote, having outspent their opposition 9-1. We still have won 33 elections. They've won four now. And I think the country is still deeply divided on the issue of same-sex marriage.
I asked Land whether he was concerned about poll data, such as we've reported on this program, that show almost 20% of the country say they have no religious affiliation at all.
That implies they don't have any religion, and most of them do. What you've got is a disaffection with organized faith. And I can understand reasons for that. I've had reasons for being tempted to be disillusioned with organized faith myself.
Land has called the culture wars a titanic struggle for the nation's soul.
It's still a titanic struggle. And it's far from being settled. Oh, I don't think either side's winning. I think both sides are winning in different places. We have a gigantic rift running through our culture. And it's a rift that doesn't run between denominations and between institutions. It runs through them. It makes less difference whether you're a Catholic or a Baptist than whether you believe in traditional values and traditional morality or whether you're a postmodernist. If you had the same America that you had in 1972, when 75% of Americans lived in homes where they were married, Romney would have won in a landslide. But we live in 2012 America, where only 48% of Americans are married and living in homes, when 53% of our babies that are now born to women under 30 are born out of wedlock, we're in deep trouble.
For Land, the antidote to social problems is a return to religion.
Spiritual revival. I do not see us, the traditional values folks, winning this struggle without a spiritual revival that ripens into an awakening and culminates in a reformation. The single greatest advantage, Bob, that an American can have today, and it trumps all others, is to be born into a home with a mother and a father who stay married to each other. If you're born into such a home, it trumps religion, it trumps ethnicity, it trumps economic rank, it trumps IQ, it trumps everything. And yet, over half of our children have lost that home by the time they're seven. As far as I'm concerned, that's collective societal child abuse.
Land was very close to President George W. Bush, and he publicly endorsed Mitt Romney. He is scathing about President Obama, as he indicated when I asked him whether he thinks Republicans and Democrats can find a compromise to avoid going over the fiscal cliff.
It's there, but the president has to want it. I don't think he wants it. I don't think the Democratic leadership wants it. I think they've come to the conclusion that it's to their political advantage to let us go over the cliff.
You really think that the President of the United States wants to do damage to the country?
No, I don't think he thinks it will. I think he's wrong, but I don't think he thinks it will. For all of his brilliance, this man has never mastered economics 101.
Before we finished, I wanted to ask Land about Christian evangelizing, trying to convert people of other faiths.
Do Christians have an obligation to try to evangelize Muslims?
Absolutely. Just as they have an obligation to try to evangelize Jews and Mormons and anyone else who's outside the Christian faith. And Mormonism is, at the very least, another religion. It's not the Christian faith.
What do you say to a Muslim or a Jew or anybody else who says, well, Christianity's okay for you, that's fine, but for you to try to tell me that I must convert is to disrespect my religion?
Well, if the price of respecting your religion is to disrespect mine, the price is too high.
But you would be comfortable telling Mitt Romney that you think his is not, that he's not a Christian?
Sure. That'd be my duty as a Christian.
Land says he's retiring from his position at the SBC next year, but not from the culture wars. He says of the social issues, I'll probably continue to talk about them. In other news, celebrated musician Dave Brubeck died Wednesday. He was 91 years old, a day short of 92. In 2009, Brubeck spoke about his religious influences with Bob Faugh for Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Known primarily as a jazz musician, Brubeck also composed several pieces of music that dealt with religious themes, including a Catholic Mass he wrote in 1979.
When I write a piece, a sacred piece, I'm looking hard and trying to discover what I'm about and what my parents were about and the world's about.
You think religious music can change people?
Yeah, sure.
The Vatican provided more information this week on Pope Benedict XVI's new Twitter account. Benedict will have the username @Pontifex, which means Pope or Bridge Builder in Latin. He'll be tweeting in 8 languages, although not Latin, for now. His initial tweets will be answers to questions people have been tweeting him, and even he will have to observe Twitter's 140-character limit. One day after the announcement, the Pope already had 500,000 Twitter followers. That's respectable, but nowhere near pop star Lady Gaga, who has the most followers on Twitter, nearly 32 million. Benedict will send out his first tweets on December 12th, which is the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe. That day honors a vision of the Virgin Mary reported near Mexico City in the year 1531. Thousands of Catholics travel each year to the basilica built there in her name. Also on our calendar this weekend, Catholics observe the Feast of the Immaculate Conception when they celebrate the belief that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was preserved from the taint of original sin all of her life. And Buddhists mark Bodhi Day when they believe the Buddha attained enlightenment and reached a state of nirvana. According to tradition, he did so while sitting under a Bodhi tree. And finally, Hanukkah, the 8-day festival of lights, begins this weekend when Jews light their Hanukkah lamps. The holiday recalls the victory of the Maccabean soldiers over the Assyrian Greek king Antiochus. We spoke with Susan Braunstein, curator of the Jewish Museum in New York, about the museum's collection of Hanukkah lamps, the largest in the world.
The rabbis associated a miracle with the holiday, that when the ancient soldiers came to rededicate the temple in Jerusalem and they lit the menorah that was in the temple, they only had one cruse of oil to burn for one day, but miraculously it burned for 8. And so that's why we call it the Festival of Lights and why we light the Hanukkah lamp. The rabbis, going back to Maimonides and earlier, felt that the lights of the Hanukkah lamp were sacred. The rabbis actually did specify a list of materials that were preferable to use for the Hanukkah lamps, gold and silver, of course, being the best if you could possibly afford that. Most people couldn't. If you were poor and you couldn't afford a permanent Hanukkah lamp, you could use an eggshell or a nutshell or a potato carved out. The lamps used in homes for most of the centuries that Hanukkah has been celebrated were actually using oil. And then over time, in the 19th century and into the 20th century, candles became more popular for home use. It's pretty messy to use oil. We've tried it. The rabbis in ancient times didn't say much about the shape of the lamp or its decoration. And over time, the decoration on the back plates or the shafts and the arms of the lamps became amazingly elaborate and inventive and fun because there were no restrictions. And many of them actually reflect the places where Jews were living. So in our collection, for example, we have a lamp that was made in Australia, and it has kangaroos and emus on it. We have one made in the United States with the Statue of Liberty on it. Some of the lamps are actually in the shape of houses or synagogues. Wherever Jews went, they always paid homage to the ruler where they lived, knowing that their fate was often in the hands of the ruler. A very common symbol that we find on lamps that used to be from Poland are the double-headed eagle of the Austrian Empire. The lamps from Islamic lands generally don't represent human figures in objects for religious use. And so many of the lamps are in architectural form. They have the pointed arches or the horseshoe-shaped arches that are so common in Islamic land architecture. Lamps from the Indian Jewish community actually come from 3 different communities located in different parts of India. We have one that's in the shape of a Jewish star, and I think that that has to do with Zionistic aspirations of the community. We have in the collection a charming lamp made just about the time that Israel gained independence in 1948 of an Israeli soldier holding a banner with the Israeli flag, and across the top of the banner are the places where you would put the lights. One of my favorite lamps is a lamp that's in the shape of the tree of knowledge that stood in the Garden of Eden, written about in the Bible. And crawling up its trunk is a snake, the one that tempted Eve to eat the apple. And I just love the idea that one would equate the Hanukkah lamp with a tree and with one that was in the biblical story. And the whole thing is very folkishly rendered, and so it just has a special place in my heart. I really just enjoy lighting my lamp and just seeing those candles glowing and thinking about, well, my fellow Jews all over the world who are lighting the lamp along with me.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's always much more on our website as well. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music and scenes from the lighting of the National Christmas Tree in Washington.